I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session with Alvin Brooks, anti-violence advocate, former police commissioner, and now board director for the Hickman Mills School District. We'll hear about a lifetime in civil rights, politics, and law enforcement in just a minute. But first, today is another school walkout organized by young people demanding legislative action to stop gun violence. KCUR's Ellie Moxley is camped out this morning at Oak Park in North Kansas City, where students were expected to walk out at 10 a.m. And Ellie, what are you seeing?
Hi, Gina. So I'm at Oak Park. Kids are actually, they started coming out right at 10, and this walkout feels different than the walkout last month that coincided with the 1 month after the Parkland shooting in Florida. During that walkout, came out, they formed, you know, a big circle out in this area behind their school by the tennis courts. They talked, they read names of victims and remembered them, and then they went back inside. And in this walkout, kids are actually leaving school. A lot of them are planning to head to a rally in Kansas City at Hyde Park. The stakes are a little higher here, because it is the anniversary of the Columbine shooting.
So that seems to be what's raised the stakes, maybe more than just the momentum of the past month?
You know, and also just I feel like a lot of teens that have been involved in this movement over the last couple of months that have been inspired by the activism of the survivors of the Parkland shooting, I think they're frustrated that there hasn't been any real action that they can see on gun control, which is what a lot of them are agitating for. They say that they don't feel safe at school. They think it's too easy to get the kind of weapons that have been used to commit these crimes. A young woman just heard me say that and said it really is, and in kind of response. And I think that's kind of where they're feeling. I think the school's responses to these walkouts has been a little bit different. I think schools were very supportive of the first walkout last month, and this school has been very supportive of students' right to protest and to walk out. But what I've heard from around the metro is that the schools really are not as comfortable with the fact that kids are actually leaving campus this time and going somewhere else and actually, you know, leaving school grounds.
Yeah, that does seem like a whole different ball game. I mean, tell me more about the rally people are headed to.
You know, this has been something that's been very student-led. It's been organized by students across the metro in coordination with this kind of national movement. I've heard the Shawnee Mission schools are very involved. Some of the private schools like Pembroke Hill in the city are very involved. Center students, Park Hill students, they're all kind of headed to this Midtown Kansas City rally. They're going to be reading the names of some of the victims of these mass shootings. They're going to be reading some of the poetry and sharing art they have created in response to this. And they're just, you know, they're really trying to figure out what can they do. They're going to be registering to vote. A lot of these kids are kind of on the cusp of being, able to do that. You know, in Missouri and Kansas, you can get registered to vote before you turn 18, as long as you'll be 18 by election day. And for some of the seniors at these schools, that's them. They're actually going to be able to, you know, cast a ballot and, you know, select politicians that they feel like maybe agree with them more on these issues come November.
So is there anything else that you want to tell us just from being there on site at a local high school today as kids are walking out?
It's actually pretty quiet right now. A lot of the kids have, you know, they're headed out towards the football field right now. I'm still kind of by the south doors by the school. As kids have, they're actually headed out to a park and to a rally. I think one of the things that I think is really important to keep in mind right here is I think that this entire movement has been, you know, the schools are really trying to figure out how to deal with this the right way. Are they supportive? Are there consequences for walking out? And I mean, they're in kind of a hard place because I think what you're hearing from educators and administrators is, you know, they're concerned about this issue too. They want their students to be safe at school. But they're not going to be the ones that make the decision about how to protect them. That's going to be made at the state house level by lawmakers. And, you know, it's just a different calculation. So I think that's why you're seeing a lot of schools that have been supportive, like Oak Park has been. But you're also seeing, you know, a lot of administrations. I tried to go to some different schools in the metro today, and a lot of them have said, you know, we're going to let the kids walk out, but, you know, we're not really comfortable having reporters on school grounds today. And so that's kind of, they're between kind of a rock and a hard place on this one.
Well, Ellie Moxley, thanks so much.
Thank you, Gina.
Ellie is KCUR's education reporter, and she spoke to us from Oak Park High School. Alvin Brooks is in the studio with me now. Good morning, Alvin. Welcome to the show.
Jenny, good morning to you, and good morning to our listeners out there.
You are a former police commissioner, a former police officer. You got your start upholding the law during the civil rights movement, a time known for civil disobedience. You founded the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, and now you're a leader in a local school district. So I am really curious about your response, your personal response, to these student walkouts, because your vantage point strikes me as totally unique.
Well, I think it's so great that young people are taking it upon themselves to become civic-minded and politically-minded and social consciousness. And I think that that's a great moment. And I really applaud them across this nation that are doing that. The tragedy of it all is that those elected officials, and too many from the Congress to state houses, aren't really listening to these young folks. And I think even to some extent, some have indicated that outside agitation and agitators and stirring up this. And I think this is the
like
same.
Like grown-ups.
Yes. And I think this, I heard this so much during the civil rights movement here in Kansas City, well, across the nation also, because I was also chair of the Congress of Racial Equality Corps back in the 60s. And we heard that all the time, that outside agitators were coming in and do these guys, as though local folks don't have a social consciousness, a right kind of a consciousness that causes us to be that land of the free, home of the brave. It's most troubling. It's most troubling.
Well, like I said, we're going to come back to this, but I want to start your story at the beginning. You're such a Kansas City figure that I was really surprised to learn you were born not in Kansas City, but in Arkansas.
North Little Rock, Arkansas, May 3rd, 1932. By the way, 2 weeks from yesterday, I'll be celebrating another birthday. God willing, I'll be 86 years old.
Good for you. I mean, tell me about your childhood.
Well, I'm the son of a 14-year-old mother, Thomasine Gilden, and a 17-year-old father, Wilbur Lamar Herring. But I was adopted by Cluster and Estelle Brooks. My mother, when she was pregnant, had moved from Miami, Florida to North Little Rock, Arkansas. At that particular time, when a girl got pregnant out of wedlock, well, they would send you away to live with other relatives. And so my mother was sent to live with her elder sister in North Little Rock, Arkansas. But pregnant at 14, didn't get along with her brother-in-law, her adult brother-in-law. And the Brooks had lived across the road. And I say road because it was literally across the road, kind of in rural North Little Rock, Arkansas, Pulaski County. And so so the Brookses agreed to allow my mother to stay there until I was born. When I was born, May 3rd, 1932, at about 4:30 in the morning, according to my birth certificate, my mother wanted to go back to her home, which was Memphis, Tennessee. She was living with an aunt in Miami, Florida, and so the Brookses decided to ask her if they could adopt me, which she allowed that to happen. So I didn't know I was adopted until I was 22 years old. But then, in the early part of my life, I had this ailment that I could not keep anything down that I ate. I was actually kind of dying of malnutrition. So my mother, Estelle Brooks, took me to St. Louis, caught that bus going north, that Greyhound bus going north to St. Louis, where she had a sister, and used her sister's address to get me at a health center there. And she believed it was the Homer G. Phillips Health Center, which turned out to be Homer G. Phillips Hospital, the black hospital in St. Louis. Well, they didn't know what was wrong with me. They didn't know at that time, that we're talking about 19 probably 1933, late 1932, early 1933. And so, but they said he can't continue to live this way, that we give him probably about 6 years old, and he'll be suffering malnutrition that he won't live beyond age six. And I'll be 86.
I was going to say 80 years later.
So 80 years, and all those that have made those prognostications back there have long been gone somewhere. But anyway, my mother brought me back very distraught, and my father. And a gentleman came by for dinner who was known as the herb doctor of herb doctors. My dad was an herb doctor also.
Tell me more about herb doctors just real quick so we know what you're
talking
about.
They're the ones who go out into the wooded area and pick up certain kind of plants and all those kind of things and put names to them and then come back and sell them and all that, bottle them up and all those kind of things. So this doctor came by and for dinner, and my parents were telling him what had occurred in St. Louis. And he said, well, Brooks, talking to my father, he said, Brooks, you know, they say that since the boy can't keep anything down, he keeps regurgitating it up. He said they use goat's milk for people who have, at that time they called it ulcerated stomach. And he said that coats the stomach and gives some relief. And he said, you might want to buy a goat. So my dad drove down to Lake Village, Arkansas, and for $1.75 bought a goat that had just come fresh. Now, that, you know what just come fresh means, I hope the listeners don't mean that right after you have the animal that had a baby, then they give milk. And so my dad paid $1.75 for a Sanian goat. And a Sanian goat is a white goat with pink eyes, ears, and nose, and brought it back in his car. And I was on goat's milk until I was a junior in high school here in Kansas City, Missouri. So goat's milk saved my life. So I hope that anytime you or anyone else that's listening here on KCR, if you ever talk about kids, make sure that I know you're talking about either human kids or goats. Because if I think you're talking about goats, you've got a fight on your hands. So I survived that. And some other things happened. I don't know how far you want me to go into it, but the reason how we ended up in Kansas City in about...
Yeah, that was my next question.
In about 1933, my dad killed a white man over a moonshine still. There was rumored that Cluster Brooks, my dad, had the best moonshine in Pulaski County, but he was a latecomer onto the scene. And so there was a white man who had been in business and moonshine business for some time. And my dad was stealing customers from moonshine dealers around the county. And so the word got back to my dad that this man had made all these derogatory kind of statements. He was going to put Brooks out of business one way or the other. And so persons continued to gravitate towards my dad and his moonshine. And my dad had the sheriff of Pulaski County on his payroll, and he kept him stocked up with moonshine. So my dad had this sophisticated moonshine thing that he had stovepipes. So when the wind was blowing a certain way, he could turn the stovepipes where the odor of the moonshine would not go out into the atmosphere where it could be smelled, but go in the opposite direction. So this fellow, it was a Sunday morning, according to my mother, and she heard this truck drive up, and she was washing dishes in the kitchen, and my dad and some other men were out behind the house in an area where I don't know whether you or your listeners know where thickets are, but thickets are where vines and all that grow together. And he had this hidden behind these thickets. And so what happened there was this fellow drove up. White fellow drove up, and as soon as he got out of the truck, he had a shotgun. He started calling my dad names and this kind of thing, derogatory names and ethnic slurs, and he had a shotgun, a pump shotgun, and he was shooting as he was walking. And she heard my dad say, you're on my property, you're violating my rights, leave, go. And so the man kept shooting. So my dad had a .44 lever-action Winchester and just pointed it through the thickets and shot one time. And the man fell. And my mother at that time had walked on the back porch with me in her arms. And she said the man fell with his shotgun across his chest and made a statement. That man done shot me through and through. And so some of the fellows ran out who were back there with my dad. And they said, he's dead. So we didn't have a phone. So one of them said, got in his car and drove to call the sheriff. Well, sheriff came. My dad was arrested later on, but the sheriff knew him, and they came back in to get the gun because my dad had brought the gun in the house. And the sheriff came in. I sent my dad sent my dad back in the house to get the gun, and there were, another person was with the sheriff and put my dad in the back seat and the gun in the back seat and drove off, and he was arrested.
Alvin Brooks, this is quite an origin story for a future police officer, police commissioner. I mean, is this story part of what shapes your ideas about justice?
No,
and
it had
law?
Nothing to do with
nothing.
That.
Nothing.
No. And in fact, I'm just completing my memoirs, and this is all in it. I don't want to give too much. By the way, I should say to you and the listeners now, I'm taking orders for my memoirs, but it has to be cash, and I don't give receipts. So I just want you to know that.
This is a call for artists.
Yes, that's right. But then that's how we ended up. Well, my dad was arrested, and I'll hurry through this. And keeping in mind, my dad was a an herb doctor, also known in the community. And so when my mother that Monday went down to see my dad, he told her, he said, "Stella, here's what I want you to do." He said, "You know those, my various roots and things on the back porch?" And she said, "Yes." She said, "Well, you know what's known as the John the Conqueror root?" And she said, "I think I know." And so he described it to me. He said, "I want you to go get a little piece of it, wash it off, and I want you to come and try to see the judge. I want you to get close enough to the judge that you can get some spit on him." And she said, "You got to be crazy. I'm not going to spit on that white man. I am not going to." He said, "Because I'll be in jail there with you. And what are we going to do about our baby?" So anyway, Dad said, "Just do what I say." So my mother walked all the way back home with me, got that little pinch off of the larger piece of John the Conqueror, and then came back to the courthouse. Well, the sheriff said, "You cannot see the judge." He said, "Girl, you can't see the judge." She said, "I got to see him. You can't see the judge." He said, "Cluster has not been charged yet, but I don't know what the judge's going to do." But that time, the judge was in court, was breaking for lunch. So she saw the judge coming out of the courtroom. She walked up to him and said who she was. He said, "Oh, you're Brooks's wife." And she said, "Yes." He said, "I just want to talk." He said, "I'm on my way to lunch." She said, "But I need to talk." So he said, "Well, come on in." So there was a table that the judge told her to sit down, and she had me on her lap, and that the judge, and she got close enough, almost knee to knee with the judge, and she pretended to sneeze.
That's a way to get spit on someone.
Spit got all over the judge and me and her, and the judge had on a white short sleeve shirt. And she said that he was like, as he was trying to brush it off, it spread all over his shirt. And so he said, "Well, I don't know what I'm going to do. I haven't talked to him yet, but you go on back home. So by the time my mother walked back home, at that time we had outhouses, so she needed to use the restroom because at the courthouse there were segregated restrooms. So she ended up going home, and then I stood outside while she was using the outhouse, the toilet outside. And when we went in the house, my dad was home. And they attribute that to the John the Conqueror. Now, if any of the listeners want to look this up online, and you'll see what John the Conqueror is supposed to do. It has all these things that it does, and one of them is if you go to court, that you get some spit on the judge, and it'll be ruled in your favor.
So wait, so this brings you to Kansas City eventually, this whole incident. And where in Kansas City did you grow up, and like, tell me about the Kansas City of your youth.
Well, my dad had a sister that lived in Kansas City named Mittie McDonald, M-I-T-T-I-E McDonald. And she lived at 3405 Denver, which is in right east of the Veterans Hospital, for those of who are familiar with Kansas City. And so we had, and she had her husband who didn't stay at home much. So they had two bedrooms. So we slept in one, my mom, the dad, myself, and then my aunt and her husband in another bedroom. And that's where I grew up, on the Lees Dunbar area. But now it was similar to where we had come from because it was outhouses there, and most of the houses did not have running water inside. And when we stayed there until my dad got a job on the WPA, that was that work program that Roosevelt instituted as a part of the Great New Deal program. And then my daddy finally bought a couple of lots and built a house, and it eventually burned down. And we lived in a barn for a while, actually a barn where squirrels and bats and possums were in the roof, but we had to stay there because they didn't have any place else to stay.
At what age, I mean, do you remember when you first started taking an interest in becoming a police officer?
Probably, I was around 20 years old, but I had been harassed as black youth by police a number of times. Had been just strictly harassed. And one incident, I was about 10 years old and with some white friends of mine, because after our house burned down, my dad rented a house for after the barn incident, and then rented a house, then moved to another area, which was all white, poor white area, just off of Linwood Boulevard in Brighton. And in sort of not quite Northeast Kansas City, but right off of Linwood Boulevard. And so by the time they called me names, I called them names. We fought and we became friends. And I was with them on an occasion, and the police picked us up. There were five of us and piled us in the back of the police car, because one of our white neighbors had some boys who were throwing rocks in the backyard where she had at her dog, but she had her baby in a playpen. And she came out and admonished them about what they were doing, and they cursed her. So she called the police. And the police then picked us up. Well, I was not with them, and this was not my group of my friends. So they brought us back, and the lady said, oh, no, said, they're not the boys. I know them. And said, Alvin is the one who even goes to the store for my my mom, because I have a brother who is bedridden, and he goes to pick up prescription for him. And said he lives right in the next block, which was Quincy. And so that's, she said, that wasn't him. So they said, okay. So I said, well, can we go home? I live right over there, so you could see my house. And they said, no, get him back in the car. So they drove us around and drove us around. And then at the foot of the Brighton Hill at Linwood and Brighton is when there were two officers in the car, two white officers, and one who was not the driver. We could tell he'd been drinking. And so he said, okay, get out of the car. And he really admonished them about being with me, told them if they that they should not be with this anymore, and that whites don't associate with them. And so get out. And they kept saying, why? He's our friend. Why? So anyway, get out of the car. So we got out of the car. And as soon as we got out, he pulled out his gun. He told me, okay, nigga, if you can move over that hill before I kill you, and you're free in. And he just, and so I'm backing up crying. My friends were just crying. And he cocked the gun. And I'm just backing up crying and pleading. And they were screaming and hollering, don't shoot Alvin, don't shoot Alvin. And all of a sudden, Billy, who was the youngest of about 6 or 7 years old, we were turning 11, jumped up on his arm, and the gun went off. And we just ran, and the police officer jumped in the car and left.
Does not sound like the kind of police officer role modeling that would make someone say, I want to be one of them.
But now we're fast forward about 10 years after that. And then there are some other incidents that occurred between that time and as a black youth growing up in Kansas City, Missouri. And so I just decided my sophomore year in college that I thought I would join the police department. My dad didn't want me to join. Keep in mind, this is my adopted father. He didn't want me to join. And when I mentioned to him, I said, Dad, I was a sophomore in college. And I said, Dad, my wife and I talked about it. I was married, had three kids, and we talked about going to the police department, and we'd agreed. And so I went out and talked to my dad, who was still living in the area where this situation had occurred with regard to the police officer and the gun. And I said, Dad, I'm thinking about joining the police department. The first thing he said, why do you want to get into that mess? You know how they treat us. And I didn't tell him that I already made some inquiries and was supposed to take the test. But I didn't go in the January 1954 class because I wanted to finish my sophomore year.
But what did you tell him? Why did you want to get into it?
Well, I said, I didn't talk about it too much because he was so opposed to it. And I didn't want to try to make a case. I just decided I wouldn't deal with it anymore. And so I went home and told my wife about it. And she said, well, maybe you just hold off for a while. And so I just kind of let it stay at that time.
Well, we'll pick this story right back up with Alvin Brooks in just a moment. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you are listening to A Portrait Session on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm speaking this morning with Alvin Brooks, one of the first black police officers in Kansas City. He's been police commissioner, city councilman, mayor pro tem, and founder of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. Now he's a board director for the Hickman Mills School district, and he is the subject of this morning's portrait session. Alvin Brooks, hello again.
Jenna, thank you very much. And I was not one of the first black police officers. I was introduced when I spoke to a group not too long ago, and they said I was the first. But the first black police officer was in, it was 1874, and I'm not quite that old. So I came on the police department in 1954, a few years later. Thank you for saying that anyway.
But you were certainly one of the very few in the department at that time.
Oh, yeah, very much so. In the 1950s, yes. Yeah, very few.
And you were the first head of a department in the police department, right? In 1968, when you took over human resources.
Human relations department when I was appointed. And I was appointed right 6 weeks after the riot in Kansas City, Missouri.
So what was that like for you? I mean, just to be one of the few black police officers on the force during the civil rights movement, I imagine kind of walking a line between this fight for social justice, which involves civil disobedience, and on the other hand, you are there to uphold the law.
Well, the you know, Brown versus Board of Education was in May 1954, and I came on the police department in June of 1954, and so it was moving into that whole movement of Dr. King in 1957, and then all the riots that took place in the 60s after the death of Dr. King, but during the time of police department, it was. The police department was pretty much like it was when I described the incident of what happened to me and my white friends when I was around 10 years old. The same remnants of racism and discrimination and segregation was there. Police officers were, black police officers were relegated to just two districts in Kansas City. Just a few years before that, in the early 40s, if you're a black officer, you could not arrest a white person. You could detain them until the white officers came to take them in. You could appear in court against them, but not take them down. And so the late Lloyd DeGraff Reed Sr., when was being interviewed by the Board of Police Commissioners, and when you came on the department then, you're interviewed by police commissioners. And after they had interviewed Lloyd DeGraff Reed, they asked him, "Lloyd, is there anything you want to ask us?" And he said, "Yeah, can I arrest anybody?" And Lloyd said that they looked at each other kind of strangely, and they said, "Well, excuse us a minute." So he left the room and he came back and said, "Yes, you can arrest anyone." Well, that's what broke the line. Just by him raising that question, it raised a level of awareness and cautious on the part of the police commissioners at that time. So when I came on in 1954, we could arrest anybody, but we were still relegated to two districts that was pretty much represented the black community.
You've mentioned that your dad didn't want you to join the police force and that you yourself had really, it sounds like traumatic interactions with the police force yourself. What made you want to be part of it?
Well, because as I grew and I had a relationship, developed a relationship with a young Jewish fellow named Fred Sachs. And we're the same age. My birthday was in May. His was in June. And we met at an organization called Fellowship House, and we became friends just throughout our lives until he passed just about 7 years ago. And we kept in contact. We went out together. He got married, and all we the four of us would go out together. So we were really friends, not associates, but really friends. And so we were kind of involved in this interchange of I learned a lot about Judaism, and he knew more about Christianity than I did. But we had this game that we played at one of the drug stores at 31st and Prospect, and we would go in, and because I couldn't eat at the counter, I found that, and he and two other white female and another white male, they'd go in and order for four people, and then by the time the hot dog and the shake or the hamburger and the shake came up, then I'd sit down, and the game was how fast could we eat before the manager came out and told me to get out. And so that's the way we started social consciousness. And then I think that that social consciousness moved me into where maybe if I got on, I could just at least help make things a little better. And that's been kind of my life for the last 60, 70 years.
You know, violence in Kansas City neighborhoods and communities is something you've addressed throughout your career in a lot of different ways. And I want to talk about that. But first, can you just let me in on what makes you so passionate about that issue in particular?
About a reduction of violence?
Yeah.
Well, mainly because I think, you know, violence is a human phenomenon, and we are born, I believe, regardless of our race or ethnicity or our faith or whatever the case, our gender, whatever the case might be. We're born with bad and good, good and evil. I think that's why the Creator gave us freedom of will. We can either be good or be bad, and indifferent. And I just felt that maybe getting into this and trying to be one of the many voices about nonviolence, and this was before Dr. King came on the scene, but that we can be human towards each other, and that I'm a believer that, as it says in the Torah as well as the Bible, which the first five books of the Holy Bible of the Torah, that we're all made in that image of the Creator. And I add to that the likeness and image. And that being the case, I think there's a connection that we have, a connectiveness, if you will, we have to each other, that the Creator wants us to have the relationships and do those kind of things together, that where race and class and ethnicity and gender and violence is something that we all take on together to reduce the things that bring divisiveness, if you will, between us. My passion is, violence is learned behavior, and so being just one of many that said we don't have to live this way. That I think the Creator created us better than this.
You know, I mean, you have worked toward a reduction of violence, not just on the police force, but also by creating the ad hoc group against crime, by going personally on the radio and asking for crime tips, by comforting families of murder victims, and then through a career in politics as well. Is there a limit to what you can do from within law enforcement? I mean, what do these other arenas allow you to do that your police work wasn't?
Well, I think it takes a collaboration of all of what our society, our communities, our neighborhoods, our homes are made up of. And I think it takes all of those to want to reduce crime and violence. And earlier we talked about the young people who are walking out, and I'm hoping
walking out of school today,
walking out of the schools, and in Columbine or Sandy Hook or wherever it might be, just what the 14th of last month when the kids in Florida and at Parkland High School. I mean, I think it takes all of these kind of forces to raise the level of awareness and consciousness. And I'm hopeful and prayerful that as we do this, that we'll prick the conscience of those powers that be, whether it's in the Congress, whether in the state houses or wherever it might be, that gun violence is we can reduce it. Stamp it all out, I doubt it. But we can certainly reduce it. But there's the forces that are so strong, and the money is so strong. The NRA has such power over politicians. And I cannot believe that the real true consciousness of these politicians that wave the Second Amendment flag really believe in what they're doing. It's a matter of, can I continue to get elected to office? And so the office is more important than our children dying in school. The Second Amendment, as they're interpreting it, is more important than our young people and people down on the streets of America. And so we're one of the most violent nations in the world, and we don't have to be this way.
I guess I hear you saying that there are limits not just to what you can do within law enforcement, but limits within politics too.
Yeah, but it takes all of these. The police department cannot—police departments very rarely prevent crimes. I mean, they come in after the fact. But it's up to communities and neighborhoods and the persons in the community to do that. I mean, you can drive police cars all around, and unless a police officer could be on in every household to keep domestic violence, other kind of violence going on in neighborhoods, and you just don't have enough police officers to do that. So it depends upon how that neighborhood polices itself, how that community polices itself, how we as a nation police ourselves. And so police come in after the fact, after the 911 call. Rarely do they get there before when they get there, the homicide or the shooting has already occurred.
You know, I mean, this might be kind of a difficult question, but there was a kind of dark moment when you were, I believe you were a police commissioner at the time, the Sophia Salva case, which Just a warning to our listeners, it's a disturbing case and might be triggering for some people, but it was the case of a pregnant woman who was pulled over by police officers.
I remember, yes. And attorney Sidney Willens was one of the consultants to the attorney that handled that case. I'm very familiar with it. This was, I think, a Nigerian woman, as I recall, but at least a person from one of the African nations who was pregnant. And we've had cases like that.
And just for those who don't remember, I mean, she was begging for help from medical attention, which she didn't get.
And the things that were said to her were most derogatory. And to have another woman to say things like that to her, who should have been very, not sympathetic, but empathetic with her when she made her plea.
Some people, particularly in the Black community, wanted a stronger response from you than they got at the time. And I just wonder if you can reflect on that a little bit.
I wasn't the police commissioner when that occurred. I was with the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. And the thing of it is, you know, I think sometimes we jump the gun in terms of how he's, and until the investigation was complete. But after the investigation was complete, my position was very, very much so where the police department was wrong. And action should have been taken towards the police officers involved. So I even as a police officer, I was one who always spoke out when police officers were said, well, let's go up to the and who's got the queer patrol, which means the Memorial Mall where gay men were sought by so-called straight men. And I made the statement, why don't we start arresting those folks who are soliciting these, you know, and of course it didn't go too well. And when I raise issues about race, so I have been one, record will speak for itself, that's raised the voice when I saw and witnessed or even when the investigation was complete and I saw that it was either right or wrong. If I feel it was wrong, I called it. And I can remember when a 14-year-old was killed. And I think one of the things that police departments had habits of doing, if someone is trying to get away and trying to back and then they kill the person, I think there's a lawsuit now pending in Overland Park where this, I think, 17-year-old kid, and someone had called in, he'd back, and that's being litigated now. So it's been fine. I mean, those kind of things, I think, that the community has to speak out about. But we have to do, our whole motto was when we was with the Congress of Racial Equality, is investigate before you demonstrate. And I say, so before you declare someone being wrong, you ought to make sure that you know that's the case.
Well, we are going to get right back to this portrait session with Alvin Brooks in just a minute. Alvin Brooks, stay with me through one more break, okay?
Okay, thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session with Alvin Brooks, a noteworthy civil rights activist in Kansas City with a lot of claims to fame for his work in politics and law enforcement. Last year, he stepped down as police commissioner to get involved with the Hickman Mills School District. Alvin Brooks, hello again.
Well, thank you again, Jen, for being with you.
What inspired you to step down from such a prominent role to get involved in public education so intimately?
Well, I chose to step down because my term was up, and I knew that the new governor was not going to reappoint me, and so I decided to move on to something else. I had promised my late wife and my five daughters that the Board of Police Commission was my last political public hurrah. And then being within the Hickman Mills School District, and knowing the difficulties had, provisional accreditation, 6,200 kids, 90% African American, eligible for 100% free lunch, 61% mobility rate, and I figured that I had gone to court enough, both family court as well as the adult court, and see the number of young African-American males in being incarcerated. And education was a pipeline. The lack of education was a pipeline to prison, to the juvenile and the criminal justice system. So I said, well, encouraged by a number of patrons as well as some of the board members and administration, I decided, well, I just leave the Board of Police Commission, since I knew it was a matter of time, and join the one of seven Hickman Mills board members.
Tell me more about your own high school experience.
Well, I went to elementary school, Dunbar Elementary School, out in the Leeds-Dunbar area, which is just east of the Veterans Hospital. And then I went to R.T. Cole's Vocational High in the eighth grade, 46-47 school year. And that was the first year they had the eighth grade. Prior to that, you went from the seventh grade to the ninth grade. And so I got caught up in that. And decided I want to be a great musician. And so I had played several instruments at the time. And so I went part-time to Lincoln High School, which still stands, a castle on the hill at 2111 Woodland, now Lincoln Preparatory Academy. It was Lincoln High School at the time. And I remember now, this is all pre-1954. We were segregated. There were 10 high schools, 2 black and 8 white, and we didn't interact at all. And in fact, we got one edition, books when our white counterparts got the later edition books, and they wrote us little notes, little pen pal notes in the books that they sent our way. And so from R.T. Coles and Lincoln, graduating in 1950, the junior college, we could not go to the white junior college at 39th and McGee, so the third floor of Lincoln High School was the junior college. And it's been said that in our two high schools, we had more master's and PhD degrees than they did in the eight white high schools. So that's when I went on the police department after finishing 2 years of junior college, and then eventually going to UMKC and earning an undergraduate degree in history and government and a master's degree in sociology.
When you were in high school, you became, at that time, a young father.
I became a young father, yes, and married, and 63 years as of 5 years ago. Would have been 68 years this coming 23rd of August if my wife was still with us.
What was that like for you?
Which one?
Becoming a young father in
well,
high school.
Well, you know, I wasn't in high school. That was my graduation year. My wife was a sophomore. But no one said to us that you needed to get married. We just decided, and God was with us all the way, and still is, that we were going to get married. And so when it was announced to my father, my adopted mother had passed. And keep in mind that my biological parents my mother didn't find me until 1954. And 9 years later, she helped me find my biological father. So I don't even want to leave the air without knowing that we did hook up with my biological parents. But so my adopted mother had passed. She passed in March of 1950. We got married in August of 1950. And we decided to get married. And God and family and helped us through all of this. And for 6 kids, and we lost our son 13 years ago. But six children and 18 grand, 27 great, and 12 great great. And I always say that the Brooks family is like rabbits that we produce every 29 to 35 days.
Well, how you mentioned that you had promised your wife and daughters that police commissioner would be your last political hurrah.
Yes.
How did you balance the demands of family with your service to Kansas City, which seems so all-consuming?
I had a wife, Carol, Laverne Rich Brooks, who was we were both adults before our time, and maturity, young, made good decisions. And she encouraged me to go back to school. I had promised my adopted parents that I would get an education. In my household it was that if you get it in your head, they can't take it away from you. If you get it in your hands, they can take it. And white society will do that to you, so you have to get it into your head. And always be honorable and respectful and trustworthy. And carry yourself with good character and carry your heads up and be a proud black man. And that was what I was instilled upon in me. And so getting into marriage as a youngster, we had a lot of support. We had support from my adopted father. We had support from my wife's grandmother and people in and out of church who all supported us and thought a lot of loved us and we loved our kids, and so we were just one of God's special couples.
Do you, when you think about your career, and largely in the police force, but also in politics, Is it hard for you to see the tensions between communities and police officers?
It is, but it's nothing new. We had the riot in 1968 that started the 9th of April. I don't know whether you want to just celebrate it, but at least recognize what happened 50 years ago after the death of Dr. King. And so police-community relations have to some degree changed, far from what they ought to be. And I think that there are police chiefs and police officers who are much more educated, much more in tune to what's going on in the society in general, in their specific areas in particular. And I think that it's a new consciousness, but it's far yet from what it ought to be and can be and should be. And I think that it takes all of us to make it that way, to impress upon those political leaders and appointed leaders. Police chiefs are not elected in this community and across this country. They're appointed by either the mayors or city managers. And I think that we have to continue to keep that whole issue on front and center and talk about that. Of course, police departments are just microcosm of what the society, what the community is all about. So if you've got that division between police and communities of color, you've also got that division between the white community and communities of color. And so to bridge that gap, it has to be a lot of conversation, a lot of soul searching, a lot of honesty and upfront. The faith community has a role to play in this also. So that's how I see the whole picture today.
Is it, as someone who has been part of the civil rights movement and part of the police force, is it strange for you to see today that so much of the social justice community perceives itself to be at odds with law enforcement?
Well, then they should not be. I think that we're all in. I remember the speech that the late Whitney Young said, and they attributed to Dr. King, but I think it was Whitney Young who said, "We might have come here on different ships, but we're in the same boat now." And so I think that we need to understand that if there's an injustice anywhere, then we're all responsible for trying to make it right. And so I think that whether you're in the civil rights today, whether you're one of the major organizations that's fighting for equal opportunity and justice and freedom and fairness, I think that the institution of criminal justice system has to be a part of that change, not from within as well as from without, and more of a consciousness about who we are and what we do and how we treat each other and how we relate to each other. It has to be high on the priority. Our nation still has not dealt with the whole issue of race. And then in recent months, we see a resurgence of those that have been kind of lying dormant, waiting for somebody to come along to spark the fire where bigotry and racism and sexism and homophobia and Islamophobia, all those things have come up that we as a nation are going to have to deal with.
How do we deal with them?
Well, I think it's up to each one of us to be socially conscious to that extent and make sure that those folks that we elect, whether the city, county, state, or the national level, are conscious also and don't allow those forces to influence us to go backwards. So there's no place to go but forward. And we're better than what we're experiencing now. We're a better nation. We're better people. And I'm an optimist. You know, when I went to bed 2 o'clock this morning after reading through some of my memoirs, I don't know whether you, Jenny, have learned this as growing up. You used to say this little prayer: "Now that I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take." What a terrible thing to learn to kids because you're afraid to go to sleep. But now I say that every night. But I add this to it because a friend of mine, Carl Boyd, said, "Well, Al, supposing you wake up." So now I say all that, and then I say, "So God, if I should wake up, please help me to do something that would be pleasing to you in helping someone along the way." That's my prayer every night. And I thank God for my wife and for my family and for what God has been to me in my life, and hope that in my freedom of will that I've taken the high road and done the kind of things that God would have me to do.
Our time is up. Alvin Brooks, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Jenny, joining you.
This has been a portrait session, which means Alvin Brooks' story will be online later today, along with photographs by the talented Paul Andrews. You'll be able to get it all with the audio of today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org Central Standard, and it is the weekend, but if you need some listening material between now and Monday, check out the podcast I host. It's called Midwesternish, and you can get it from NPR One or download episodes at kcur.org. Speaking of which, we have a live taping of that podcast Monday at 6:30 at the Record Bar. That's featuring stories about the crazy Midwestern road trip experience. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with intern Matt Groby. This week, we've also had help from Linda Scher and Genevieve Desmarteaux. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs, and Paul Andrews is our portrait session partner. I'm Gina Kaufman, over and out.